I'm Christopher Lydon, in conversation with a young American journalist, 3 years out of Yale, who spent 2.5 of those years working with a Palestinian news agency on the West Bank, but was detained by Israeli officials this winter, held for a week, and denied re-entry. Free press under Israeli occupation is just one of the questions I want to hear about from Jared Malson. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jared Malson, you're doing something that I consider doing myself right after the 1967 war, which was to go to the occupied territories, the refugee camps, and report what I saw. But we had a first baby coming and I didn't go, but I've wondered ever since, what if? I keep hearing, Jared, that Palestinians use an awful lot of new digital media like ours to network with each other and with the world, but I'm dying to see it and hear and know how it works. What can you tell us?
Yeah, that's right. When you hear about the West Bank and Gaza, the image you get is kind of desolate refugee camps and people living in desperately poor conditions. And that story is partly true. But it's also true that Palestinians as a people, both inside the occupied territories, inside Israel, and in the diaspora, are incredibly well educated. And they're also incredibly politically and media savvy. And what I mean by that is two things. One is that people know what's going on. There's a lot of advanced degrees and a lot of people who have nothing to do with them. I mean, the guy who used to run the corner shop next to my office had a PhD in engineering, but couldn't leave and couldn't really apply his skills. But what I mean about the media is that it's an incredibly free press in one sense compared to the rest of the region. It's a lot freer than in Jordan or in Syria.
Really?
Yes. And Palestinians, in my experience, pay incredibly close attention to the media. They're always glued to Al Jazeera, and they read websites like Man, which is the news agency I work for. I have been into, some of the densest refugee camps and out to Bedouin encampments, for example, and you'll always see, a satellite dish and a TV hooked up so that they can watch the cable news. I mean, I remember I interviewed a guy, a Bedouin guy who lived in this kind of no man's land between Jerusalem and Ramallah a few years ago. And his house was about to be knocked down by the Israeli army so that they could build the wall, which, they're building through the West Bank. And still, he had a generator hooked up solely so that he could watch Al Jazeera, in his tent the week before his house was knocked down.
What does radio have to do with the picture? And, of course, we know radio can be toxic. It was in Rwanda. We know it can build bridges, too. What are the possibilities and what goes on today?
The Palestinians have their own radio stations. There's a wide range of them, of varying levels of quality and of political slant. Israelis also have their own radio stations in Hebrew. There was a few years back a radio station called Ram FM, which broadcast in English, and the idea was that they would broadcast both in the occupied territories and in Israel, and it would be sort of trying to establish one framework for news that both people would listen to. And what happened to them actually is that they were shut down by the Israeli army. This is what I was speaking about in my lecture here at Brown last night, was about how Israel, even though it says it wants Palestinians to have civil society institutions like media, knowingly or not, it is shutting down those institutions and sometimes physically bombing them and crushing them.
What do you mean knowingly or not? How can they not know?
Well, I'll put it this way. In Israel's stated policy, they line up with the international community, with the United States, in terms of saying that they want Palestinians to build the institutions of a state. But in practice, what they're doing is they're doing things like deporting journalists like me. In Gaza, for example, during the war a year ago, they bombed many of the institutions of civil society, like the parliament building, the president's compound. Media institutions were also bombed. And I was in Gaza in September and, saw for myself, and it was really startling going to the parliament building and seeing it in ruins. And it's hard to imagine in a way the Palestinians having a state of their own when the institutions of that state are literally in ruins. Mm. So,
how do you define the news on the West Bank these days, Jared? I mean, in newspaper talk, I mean, what's the lead? What's the Jared Nelson lead this week? Is it, I mean, is it the economy? Is it culture? Is it politics? Is it desperation? Is it ferment? Is it hope? Where is it?
I wish I could say it's hope, but I think it's the opposite. I think it's desperation. Right now, the storyline in the U.S. media about the Middle East is about the conflict between the U.S. and the Netanyahu government concerning settlements.
Right.
And right now, there's the AIPAC conference.
Right.
You know, I was on the phone this weekend with a few of my friends in the West Bank, and the things that they are talking about, though, are completely different. Over the weekend, there were four Palestinian teenagers who were shot dead by the Israeli army,
yes.
Two of them in demonstrations and two of them just not in a conflict situation at all. And it's those type of violations that have people really upset. And I think it's actually a very volatile time there. There's a lot of demonstrations happening and a lot of unrest. That's really one of the things that I've learned over the course of 3 years in the Middle East is that on the ground, you get a very different sense of how things are going than you would kind of reading about it over here, because there's an emphasis on the diplomatic side of the story on U.S. involvement there. But if you're on the ground, I mean, you can kind of sense the wind shifting. And right now I get the sense that the conflict is in one of those periods where it's going to start becoming more violent. You know,
in the case of four teenagers being shot dead, where does the story go? Is there ever an answer? Do people simply mourn? Does it become political between Palestinian factions? Or where does it go on the second, third day?
That's a good question. I mean, usually, you know, in Muslim society, when someone dies, you have to bury them within 24 hours. They call it martyred when you're killed by the in conflict, and there's usually like a funeral procession, which becomes an outlet for people to express anger.
Mm.
In terms of the deaths themselves, I mean they're very rarely investigated. I've witnessed hundreds of such incidents over the years, and I've called the Israeli army and I'll ask them, why did this happen? You know, is there going to be an investigation? Usually the Israeli military's approach is they launch what they call an initial investigation, and lo and behold, what they usually find is that their forces did no wrong and they didn't violate any rules or laws.
Mm.
I mean, I'll give you an example from during the war in Gaza. What I heard from some journalist colleagues in Gaza was that an unmanned Israeli drone fired a missile onto the roof of one of the main media complexes in Gaza City. There are two towers where most of the foreign news bureaus are housed. And I spoke to three different people who I know who said they were all on the roof of this building, reporting to camera, broadcasting live. The roof of the building was very clearly labeled. There's a huge sign painted on the floor that said TV, and still they were attacked from the air. I called the Israeli army spokesman and asked what happened, and they said, again, based on an initial investigation, IDF forces were not operating in the area.
Mm.
And so I said, well, so you're saying that it was someone else's unmanned drone that was operating in the area? And they said, well, yes, I guess so. I mean, even
Jared, you sound like an old-fashioned police or fire or news reporter, but you don't get the answers that we expect.
Right.
If it happened
right.
in New York or Boston or Philadelphia, there would be an answer. It would probably be a citizen protest too.
Right. You know, the Palestinian territories is one of those places where, people die and you don't really get answers afterwards.
Introduce yourself, Jared Nelson. Who are you? Where did you come from and what's the plan here?
Yeah, I'm originally from Hanover, New Hampshire. And as you mentioned, I graduated from Yale in 2007. And I was working...
The Yale Daily News guy?
Yes, that's right. I worked for the Yale Daily News. I also edited a very short-lived magazine called The Hippolytic. And I moved to the Middle East after graduating and was very lucky to get this job working at the Palestinian news agency, MAN. And that's what I was doing until January, until I was thrown in jail for a week and then deported.
What took you to the Palestinian side of the story?
I guess a natural inclination to give voice to people who don't have a voice. One of my heroes in journalism is Amir Ahas, the Israeli journalist for the Haaretz newspaper. And something that she has told me repeatedly over the years is that you should always go to places where other journalists are not going. And I really think that that is a golden rule, is always to look at the side of the story that's not being told. And I was very lucky to be able to do that, and Palestinians were able to support me in doing that.
When you write home or postcards to old friends, what's the net of what you've seen, learned, want desperately to tell people about what you've learned?
There's nothing like being on the ground and seeing what's happening with your own eyes. You know, you can read about settlements or about the wall, for example, that I mentioned. And it's another thing to be, you know, in Bethlehem, which is the city I lived in for 2.5 years, and you see how the wall, you know, cuts through, it cuts across the main road to Jerusalem, and it wraps around a gas station and then cuts in between two houses and through an olive field. And it's just completely mangled the city. And something about being that there and seeing it with your own eyes, it's kind of, there's truth to it that you can't argue with. And so the challenge, I guess, is to get that across in reporting, in writing, and in photography or whatever medium you're working in.
It's quite amazing to me how little we see of that wall in American in American media.
Right. My suspicion is that part of that has to do with American journalists and where they're going and not going. I think it's also part of a deliberate Israeli attempt to stigmatize like places where Palestinians live and keep journalists and other international witnesses out. For example, when the Pope visited Bethlehem last spring in May, there was this big flap because the Palestinian Authority was going to host an event with the Pope at a refugee camp in Bethlehem. And he was going to speak at an amphitheater that they specially built for the Pope that it happened to be right next to the wall. And the Israeli army actually came in and shut down the whole thing before it happened. They said, you can't have this event here, even though it was in territory that is nominally controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Soldiers came in and handed out these notices saying that you cannot host the Pope here. And it was clearly because they didn't want to have pictures of the Pope standing in front of the wall. So the whole thing really demonstrates, I think, how the Israeli government is cognizant of what information is getting out. And they're very savvy, I think, about controlling what types of information, what types of images make it out of there.
We didn't see much of the ground reality of the war in Gaza either. And to this day, we don't see an awful lot of graphic, persuasive, authentic coverage of that scene. What else don't we see? You're reporting sort of from the dark side of the moon.
Yeah. No, I mean, Gaza is a really good example. I've used the phrase dark side of the moon to describe Gaza in like the sense of how distant it can seem sometimes. But yeah, is a perfect example of it's a place where, you know, foreign journalists have been completely banned. The vast majority of foreign journalists are completely banned from going. A few people who have special permits from the Israeli government can go. And when foreign journalists do go, they go for a few days and they do a story and then leave. The international media presence there is kept alive by Palestinians. And actually what happened during the war last year was that the Israeli government, because they had barred foreign journalists from going, is that Palestinians for the first time were, you know, writing stories under their own bylines in foreign newspapers, like the Independent newspaper, for example, in Britain. Their stringer in Gaza is this guy named Feris Akram, who wrote a front page story that appeared in the Independent about the death of his own father, who was a judge in the Gaza Strip, and who was a guy who resigned when the Hamas government came to power because he wanted to maintain the independence of the judiciary, and then was killed by the Israeli army during the incursion. These stories came out because foreign journalists couldn't get in. The story there right now is that things are the same. It's the status quo since the end of the war because Gaza is under complete closure. There's been no building materials are allowed in by the Israeli army, no concrete, panes of glass, iron rods, this kind of thing. And so people are still living in tents. You know, we're now 2 winters out from the war and thousands of people still live in tents or they live in the rubble of their homes. And no one's talking about it, in part because it's not very spectacular. You know, it's just kind of the situation is the same there, and it's hard to tell that story in a way that still captures headlines. And it's the same story in the West Bank, really. Some of the stories that I've reported on over the years, I think, focus on like these aspects of the occupation that I think are completely not spectacular. Like one issue, for example, that I'm interested in is water. Israel and the Palestinians share all their water resources. The Israelis take about 5/6 of it for themselves, which means that if you live in the West Bank or Gaza, your water gets shut off for a week or 10 days at a time in the summer routinely, which means that if you live, for example, in a refugee camp in Bethlehem, there is going to be 10 days or 2 weeks in the summer where you can't wash yourself, you can't wash your children, you can't take a shower, you can't cook food, and it's incredibly dehumanizing. But it's one of these issues that you just don't hear about because there's no explosions going on. It's in these little daily lived ways that people live occupation, and that's, I think, what the real meaning of it is. And so then when you see images on TV of Palestinians throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers and you wonder what that's all about, what CNN is going to tell us is about what's happening right now, like right this instant, and we're not going to hear about the fact that, you know, those kids who are throwing stones, you know, like, haven't had water for 2 weeks. So that those are the stories that I'm interested in a way.
You know, in general, one feels just a deep battle going on, much of it below the surface and invisible. But in the whole U.S.-Israeli relationship, ever since Gaza, and the dust-up around housing for Jews, new housing for Jews in Jerusalem, announced at the time of Joe Biden's visit, is just a piece of it. There's every kind of tension now around the AIPAC meeting in Washington as we speak. I don't remember this ever being so contested. Hillary Clinton has been sort of jaw to jaw with Bibi Netanyahu as one couldn't have imagined in recent years. And nobody still knows what went down at the White House last night between President Obama and and President Netanyahu. But what do Palestinians see, and what do you see going on around all these different events? What's happening? What's underway, if anything? Where are we headed?
Where we're headed, I think, is more of the same. Really, I mean, I think it's absolutely admirable that the Obama administration is taking a tougher tone with the Israeli government right now, but unfortunately, my sense is that the Netanyahu government, they really feel like they've got Obama's number on settlements. And they, because, you know, the Obama administration capitulated a year ago. They backed down from their original demand for a settlement freeze. And I think politically, Netanyahu felt emboldened from that. The Obama's people are trying to make an issue of it now, but I think they sort of shot themselves in the foot already.
And yet you sense, don't you, Jared, that this is a huge establishment alliance being formed here, and it goes from General Petraeus saying that it's costing the American interest militarily to have this conflict just bleed forever. Tom Friedman in the New York Times, who is a pretty party line guy, says, you know, it's time to tell the Netanyahu government, friends don't let friends drive drunk. This is strong language. And it doesn't happen altogether by accident.
When Hillary Clinton says these things, and when the Obama administration says these things, all they're doing is upholding longstanding U.S. policy. I mean, the U.S. embassy in Israel is in Tel Aviv precisely for the reason that the U.S. government does not recognize Israeli sovereignty in East Jerusalem, east of the Green Line. And they have repeatedly assured the Arab League and the Palestinian Authority over the years that East Jerusalem will go to the Palestinians. Not only that, in the State Department's human rights report about Israel and the occupied territories that they issued only last week, they designated East Jerusalem occupied territory. So all they're doing is upholding the same policy that has been in place since the Carter administration and has been upheld since every president since then. It's really just a question of whether we're going to stand up for our own viewpoint on the matter, which is consistent with international law. And it's also consistent with what the Palestinians want. And so yeah, and that's to be it's to be praised. Absolutely.
What do the Palestinians see happening in all of this?
I think that if you ask Palestinians about it, they'll be more pessimistic about what's happening. They've seen a lot of U.S. presidents come and go, and you know, some of them have been more permissible with the Israelis than others, but things have really only gotten worse over the course of almost 20 years of the peace process. And the settlements have always been expanding, and they continue to. You know, Gaza remains under complete closure, and so there are very few concrete reasons for people to have hope right now. And so the challenge, I think, for the Obama administration will be to demonstrate that they can really, you know, get the Israelis to ease restrictions on people's daily life, to give them some reason to have faith in the peace process, because right now they don't.
People have wondered for many years, Jared, will we ever see a Palestinian Gandhi, a forthrightly nonviolent champion of peace as well as negotiations and change? And some people wonder whether the new Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, is such a person. What do you think?
You know, it's interesting. People ask me that question a lot. Where is the Palestinian Gandhi? And my response is that he's in jail. There are lots of people who are champions of nonviolent modes of political protest. Palestinians have a huge tradition of nonviolence. They protest every day, every week in the West Bank, everywhere, and in Gaza also. The most of the tradition of Palestinian resistance to occupation has been nonviolent, and yet most of those people, the people who are leading those protests, they wind up in Israeli prisons, most of them. And so, yeah, I mean, I can name, I mean, there's people who I personally know who you know, have promoted boycott campaigns and protest marches, and all of the same techniques that were used by the civil rights movement in this country, Palestinians are also using today. But they're met with tremendous violence. Salam Fayyad is a very smart guy, but he's not a leader in the sense of like leading a popular movement. He's more of a technocrat. He's an economist. I think he has some good ideas. In the long term, I think his interests are more in terms of building Palestinian infrastructure and institution building, and not necessarily building a grassroots movement.
One of those Palestinian peacenicks, I think it's fair to say, Mustafa Barghouti, of the many Barghoutis from Ramallah, was supposed to be speaking at Brown University this week. Turns out his visa was denied. What does that tell us? What do you know about that case? What do you know about Mustafa Barghouti?
Yeah, Mustafa Barghouti is a perfect example of a Palestinian civil society leader. I mean, he's been a leader in the NGO community. He set up the Palestinian Medical Relief Committees and this whole network of mobile clinics. And he was one of, early in the Second Intifada, he was one of the leaders of these kind of nonviolent protests. He's also a very gentle and very articulate man who I've had the privilege of speaking with several times. And I have no idea why the U.S. government would delay his visa. I haven't personally followed up with the story. I only heard about it last night that his visa was delayed.
He's been here before. People can see him, as
precisely.
I just did on the Daily Show. I mean, it's not as if you'd expect to find bombs in his pockets. What can be done in a case like that? What can American people, what can the American government do to uphold the most basic sort of free press policy here?
For me, I mean, my lawyer is still following up on my case. I mean, I'm planning to continue appealing all the way to the Israeli Supreme Court if necessary. I intend to go back.
Who can help you?
The U.S. government could help me if they would apply a little pressure on the Israelis. But they are helping, actually. My senator's office, Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire, is helping with that. What people in general can do is really... you know, right now there is a campaign to boycott Israeli goods, and I think particularly products that are made in Israeli settlements that are built on Palestinian land in the West Bank.
Like what, for example?
Like, for example, the cosmetics company Ahava, they make, you know, like mud that you put on your face and this this kind of stuff. That it's actually mud that is literally taken from the land of the West Bank next to the Dead Sea. And it's an Israeli company, but it's, you know, in the West Bank illegally. It's there by force of arms. And there's a campaign to boycott them. I think this is a really, it's a basic step that people can take to kind of avoid spending their money on this kind of thing.
Jared Melson, let me ask. When people ask you, how would I find out what daily life is actually like in the world you cover, to hear from the voices of the people who live there, in all the abundance of modern media, online and in sound and pictures, where do you point them?
My agency, Mon News Agency, which is monnews.net.
M-A-A-N.
M-A-A-N-E-W-S.net/EN for English, where you just type in M-A-A-N into Google and you'll find it. Al Jazeera also has an amazing English news broadcast, which you can get on the internet. And also their website is pretty good. The BBC does pretty good reporting, actually, on their website and on their news broadcast. It's not bad. And, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to disparage the mainstream media, quote unquote.
That's fair enough.
There's, you know, there's a lot of people who are doing good work. The Knight Ridder chain of newspapers is doing a really good job. They have a good correspondent over there. And the Christian Science Monitor, the independent newspaper in the UK, The Guardian, also is good, in my opinion.
Nothing's better than Amira Haas in Haaretz.
Yes, that's right. I mentioned Amira Haas already. She's really gold. I mean, she's a giant, in my opinion, and has been just hugely encouraging to me personally. I've had the privilege of meeting her a few times. And so I encourage everyone to read her articles in Haaretz and actually Haaretz as a newspaper in general.
Jared Melson, it's a huge pleasure to meet you and to see what a young journalist from Yale is up to in the new century. More power to you. And thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the conversation.